Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Timeouts and Momentum, a data-driven conclusion presented by Jostens. My name is Susanna. I'm a volunteer with the AVCA. And now I have the pleasure of introducing today's speaker, Dr. Ho-Fi Nguyen, assistant coach and assistant professor at Armstrong State University. A complete bio is available on the AVCA website and app. Please join me in welcoming Ho-Fi.
Good afternoon, guys. You guys hear me okay? Awesome. Thanks for spending the hour with me today. First of all, my name's Ho-Fi Nguyen. Ho actually means tiger in Vietnamese. It does not mean that in English, and I get that. I've accepted that over the years. I really appreciate you guys spending just an hour with me. This is sort of the intersection of my day job and my night job. I work as a professor, and then at night I go and I get to yell at some kids to kind of alleviate some frustration I feel in the classroom. So I appreciate the opportunity to present some of my research. But before we start, I'm going to start with showing this video. I hope you guys can see that okay. I'm sure a lot of you guys are familiar with this. This was the championship match in 2013. Here, Wisconsin is down two sets, or down one set to two to Penn State. They just scored a point to put them up 23-20. Okay. And so essentially I think this clip does a good job of highlighting the phenomenon that we're going to be exploring today. That again. Okay, here we go. Okay, so we start with a miss serve. Okay, you can kind of see the facial expression there. Probably maybe a sensing changing of the tides. Penn State puts their best server back. And she rips an ace. Okay. At this point, okay, maybe you're a coach. Okay, you're possibly considering a timeout because perhaps you sense a shift in momentum, and that's exactly what coach does here. Okay. So coach takes a timeout. We come back out from the timeout. Rips a pretty good serve, pretty good pass. Uh-oh, overpass. And now they've ran off 3 points in a row. Okay. What do you do at this point? Okay, do you call another timeout? You let it go. Okay. And here, if the commentary was live, you would actually hear Karch. Karch says, "Oh man, this would be a good opportunity for the coach to take a timeout to freeze the server." Okay. So again, coach takes another timeout. Let's try to figure this out. Okay. See if you can get the site out after the timeout. It's more fun when I show this to a non-volleyball crowd because there's anticipation. A lot of you guys know exactly what's going to happen, right? It's like, oh, okay, let's get to it. But here we go. She gets back. She rips another jumper. Oops, off the tape. There's an ace. So now we're talking about a four-point run. We have tried to interrupt this run by taking two timeouts. It hasn't worked. And let's watch the last point. And that's it, right? So obviously a lot of us haven't had this opportunity to be on this stage to play in a national championship. But even on a smaller level, we see that occurring. Okay? We'll get into a tournament, we get into a match, and the other team is starting to gain some momentum. And so the simple idea is, can we take a timeout to slow down the opponent's momentum? Okay. Before we answer this question, I just want to quickly review the literature on psychological momentum to provide you guys with some background. Okay. So if we look way back and we look into Newtonian physics, okay, what is the definition of momentum? Okay. Momentum is the product of velocity and mass. So essentially what we're saying here is that there's some kind of object in motion. Right? So it's a mass in motion. And we see momentum occur outside of physical momentum. what we see in representational momentum is this idea that we tend to overestimate sort of the displacement of objects in space. So imagine if you had a ball swinging from left to right, okay? If I were to ask you to estimate where that ball would land, ultimately what happens is you tend to overestimate how far the ball swings to the right and to the left. Okay? We also see other types of momentum, for example, operational momentum. So instead of movement in space, what you get are numerical movement. So it's this idea that we typically tend to overestimate addition and we underestimate subtraction. So if you can imagine in a classical study, you have a curtain and you have a bunch of fish swimming into this curtain, and then you are to ask to guess how many fish swam behind this curtain. Typically, people overestimate how many fish swim into the curtain as opposed to swimming out of the curtain. Right? So there's again, the idea of momentum, some movement in numerical space. And finally, behavioral momentum is this idea that when we train behavior, we train it with reinforcement, right? And even when you remove the reinforcement, that behavior tends to continue. Right? So the core of all these ideas behind momentum, one, is that as humans, we tend to believe in momentum because it helps us make predictions about the future. Right? And when we can recognize patterns and make predictions about the future, that tends to be more adaptive to our survival. And at the very core of momentum is this idea of sequential dependence. And so sequential dependence is simply this idea that we believe that events in a series don't occur in a vacuum. Okay, that events in a series, individual events in a series are related. So it's this belief that if I am serving at this point, my serve is not completely dependent or independent of the point that happened before and maybe a point that happens in the future, right? That all these events are connected. In psychology research, this phenomenon is typically studied under something we call the hot hand effect. Right? And actually, how many of you guys have played NBA Jams? Yes, I love this. When I talk to academics, there's like two hands, right? I love it. So if you don't know this game, it's a pretty old school game. It's 2-on-2 basketball. If you make two shots, the announcer comes out and says, he's heating up, right? And if you make the third shot, the announcer comes out and says, he's on fire. And at that point, you pretty much can do no wrong. You can foul people. You can goaltend. Pretty much every shot you chuck up goes in, right? So the video game industry, at least, they believe in this idea of sequential dependence. That series, events in a series are related, that they don't occur independently. In psychology research, there's mixed evidence for whether or not the hot hand effect exists. Actually, in a recent review, pretty much a tie, okay, in terms of what exists in the literature. Half of them believe, okay, half of them provide evidence for the effect that there is a hot hand effect, the other half don't believe that there's a presence of the hot hand effect. One study that I want to kind of point your attention to is a study that provides support for sequential dependence, and this study specifically deals with volleyball. Okay? In this study, and this probably would not come as a surprise to any of you guys, but in academic finding, what they did was they conducted a series of studies, and they showed that athletes, if you ask athletes about the hot hand effect, overwhelmingly, they believe that the hot hand exists. So pretty simple, if you ask somebody, are the chances of someone making a shot after they've made two shots higher than the chances of someone making a shot after they've missed two shots? Right? Typically, people agree that once you've made two, your chances of making the next one are pretty high. The same thing here with volleyball. They analyzed over 30,000 hits, and they found that the chances of you having a successful spike or a kill is significantly higher if it was preceded by a kill. Okay. And they also provided evidence to show that coaches recognize the hot hand effect, and also players recognize the hot hand effect in terms of how they distribute the ball. Okay. So typically, the ball goes to a player who's experiencing a streak. Okay. So with all that, that's to say that we find some evidence to support this idea of psychological momentum, of sequential dependence. Right? And one of the most kind of fundamental basic ideas of psychological momentum is that success breeds success. Right? If you are successful, that essentially makes it easier for you to achieve future success. If you have recently failed, that would make it easier for you to fail in the future. So psychological momentum has three qualities. Okay? One is frequency. Okay? So for example, in volleyball, we talk about how often your team gets on a run. Okay? The intensity, for example, if your team gets a big kill or there's a long rally and your middle drops her hand and just makes a huge block, right? That's an intense swing of momentum. And the one that I'm most interested in is just the duration of psychological momentum. Okay? So when a team gets on a run, how long can they maintain that, and what are some things that you can do to interrupt that? Okay? So that leads us back to the goals of timeouts if we think about psychological momentum. Okay? If the first goal, if we know that success breeds success, okay, then what we should want to do with our timeout is that we want to take a timeout so we can increase our own success. Okay? We have not been successful, so we want to increase our own success. So we want to increase our own positive psychological momentum. On the other side of the coin, we might take a timeout because we want to slow down the other team's positive psychological momentum. Right? Or if we look at if failure breeds failure, right? If we take a timeout, we want to end or at least slow down our rate of failure, right? Or increase the other team's rate of failure. So, conventional wisdom has it that timeouts are effective, right? This is why coaches use timeout. They'll wait. If you saw coach there of Wisconsin uses timeouts very strategically with this idea that when you take a timeout, it's supposed to increase your side out percentage. Right? So conventional wisdom would say that your typical rate of timeout should be lower than your rate of timeout or your rate of side out after you take a timeout. Also, if we believe in this idea of psychological momentum, that if you take a timeout earlier in the run, let's say if a team scores 2 or 3 points, right, that it should be more effective than if you took a timeout after a team has scored 4 or 5 points. So that's conventional wisdom. So I'm not the first one to ask these questions. If you guys are, I assume most of you guys are volley nerds. Maybe you have seen these articles circulated. These are a couple of blogs published by, I hope I'm not butchering his name, Mark Lebdew. He publishes a blog here, pretty interesting, at Home on the Court, and he has this series called The Truth About Timeouts. So what Mark does is he analyzes a whole season of the Polish Plus Liga, okay, so 143 matches to see to test these conventional wisdoms. And so what Mark found, and he's very very adamant about this, is that conventional wisdom must be ruthlessly challenged. Right? He found that there is no evidence for timeouts and how timeouts can influence games. So I'm going to provide a summary of his findings. But first, if you're not familiar with the Polish La Liga, I'm going to show you just a quick clip so you can kind of see the level of play. This is just a random match I found on YouTube. Just a highlight of one of the matches in this league. So you can argue it's pretty high levels of play. Certainly higher than any level I've played. That would have been me liberoing. don't hurt me. And we'll watch a couple more and then. So you kind of get an idea of what the Polish La Liga looks like, or Plus Liga. Watch the end of this rally, and then we'll move on. There we go. All right. So what are his findings? So first, okay, this is probably the most important finding that that he wants to highlight is that there is no difference in side-out percentage. Okay? that the men this level, they side out about two-thirds of the time. Okay, this is the percentage of siding out during typical play, and this is the rate of siding out after a timeout. Okay, case closed. Okay? Timeouts don't work. Go home. Just kidding. There's more. Interestingly, okay, he also found that there were less service errors after timeouts, and this is a point we'll touch on again later on. Okay, and after a third serve in the series, okay, the side out percentage drops pretty drastically. Right? There's also a lower percentage of ace, although that's not statistically significant. He finds that in the Polish league, there's better reception quality. And as a side note, I thought it was interesting that this was in the side note, that an earned side out or a first ball side out actually did increase following a timeout compared to the typical rate of play. The findings that are underlined here were actually replicated when they did another study looking at the Italian league. So again, pretty high level men's volleyball. However, given all these findings, and I think they're mixed, I think it's a mixed bag of finding, but here, Mark says there is no evidence in this league, particularly talking about the Polish league, in this season that timeouts affect the game in any useful way. So after reviewing these articles, these blog posts, I have some lingering questions. If timeouts aren't effective, why not? I think Mark's response would be that it's simply because of a cognitive bias. Right? We believe in our conventional wisdom, and we take timeouts according to our cognitive biases. And there's really no effect to that. Right? So if that's the case, right, are all cognitive biases bad? Right? Can cognitive biases actually lead to beneficial behaviors? And finally, do these findings translate to other levels of play? Okay. When I started the study, I actually started it in 2014. That wasn't published, and when it came up on my newsfeed, I cussed a little bit. I may have drank a little bit, but I think there's a lot to be parsed out still. Okay. So, what I did was I went and I looked at 234 matches that were played during the 2013 season. I started this in 2014, that's why it's the 2013 season. I chose the Big Ten because it's traditionally one of the strongest conferences, and this year it had the neat fact of featuring two teams from the Big Ten in the national championship game. Okay. So all in all, I looked at about 2,500 timeouts, and then I randomly selected 25 matches and just selected out about 3,800 plays to figure out the typical rate of play to just establish a baseline. All right, so here are some general side-out patterns that you'll see from Big Ten coaches. So this is how often coaches take timeouts based on the score differential. So what you see is about half of the coaches take timeouts when the score is about 3 points or less. And then about 80% take it within 0 to 5 points. Okay, about there's some rebels out there. They'll wait a little bit longer than that. Okay, so this is typically when coaches take timeouts. This is typically when coaches take timeouts in terms of the number of points in a run. Okay? So you'll see here again, almost we got 72%, so almost 80% here, 79%. Coaches taking timeouts somewhere between somewhere between 1 and 3 points. Right? So it seems like coaches are following this conventional wisdom that they're taking timeouts earlier on versus waiting. But how effective are these timeouts? Okay, so let's dive right into it. So the typical rate of siding out during the Big Ten this season we found was about 58%. Right? And this is the rate of siding out after a timeout. When I saw that, I was like, really, I quit. Okay? Timeouts don't work. Let's call it a day. Let's just pack it up. But then I began to explore some particular situations where timeouts may be more effective than other situations. For example, I looked at if the score was still within range. So if the score differential was between 0 and 3 points, okay, what you get there is you get a boost up to 61%. and that is statistically significant. If the score differential was more than 3, your rate drops down to 56%, although that's not statistically different. Right? So you can technically say that 56 is about the same as 58. If you took a timeout when the opponent is on a run of 1 to 3 points, okay, your side out is at about 60%, whereas if you waited, okay, your rate of siding out drops down to about 54%. Okay. It's close to significance here, but not quite. Finally, I started thinking about this, and it's interesting that we want to compare it to the typical rate of play, right? I want to know if timeouts are better than how I would typically do, although that may not be the best comparison group. Right? If you think about it, if you're down by 3 or the other team is on a 3-point run, that's not a typical situation anymore. So comparing that, taking a timeout to a typical situation probably doesn't make sense. Okay? It may make more sense to compare, let's see, what happens if a team is on a 3-point run? What happens if I take a timeout then compared to if I waited till they're on a 4-point run or so on? Okay? So that's actually down here. So the run of 1 versus 3 versus run above 3, what you get is about 5% difference. Okay, that's very statistically significant. So if you take a timeout before that cliff of 3 points happen, or actually 4 points happen, you get about a 5% return. What about if the score is within 3 versus if the score is above 3? Okay, again, you get about a 5% return. And those differences are significantly different. I also went back and I looked, what happens if you took a timeout when the game is close? Okay, so we're talking about scores of being 20 or above, and the differential is at 3 or below 3. Okay. What you get there is you get a boost up to 61%. If you notice 61% here is statistically significant, but this 61% is not, it's probably due to the sample size being smaller. But you're getting about a 3% boost compared to your typical rate of play. Okay, so what does this tell us? Okay, timeouts may be effective, okay, but it's situationally dependent. Okay. It may be effective if you use it in a timely manner. Okay, for example, while the score is closed, and if the other team hasn't gone on a very big run. Right? However, one thing to note here is it's very difficult for us to parse out whether or not this is due to psychological momentum or this is due to just the sheer fact of ability. Right? If your team gives up 3 points, it's probably not very good, and its chances of gaining a fourth point are probably not very good. Right? If your team is down by more than 4 points, maybe it just says that your team is not very competitive compared to your opponent. So we see some tenuous evidence, right? but we don't quite know. We're not exactly sold on this idea of the usefulness of timeouts. Okay. So also, if timeouts were effective, it's unclear whether or not that's affecting us. So whether when we take a timeout, we play better, or if the opponent plays worse. So I went out and I explored this question using a case study. So what we did was, this is Danielle Gotham. She's currently the assistant at Tennessee Tech. For her summer project, she went out and we collaborated on this, and we asked her to go back and watch every single play before the timeout and every play after a timeout on film. So they played 31 matches with 300 timeouts. And what we wanted to do was examine the behavior that occurs immediately after the timeout. So serving and passing behavior. So serving, Danielle just rated it on a dichotomous scale, just hard or easy. I would have preferred her to rate it on a traditional 1-3 scale, but she chose to rate it on a dichotomous scale, so that's what we have. So essentially, a serving behavior is just the rating of the serve after the timeout subtracted from the serve before the timeout. So three outcomes can occur. Your serve stays the same, your serve is tougher, or your serve is weaker. Okay. What we also did was we looked at the number of missed serves prior to the timeout compared to, or missed serves in general play compared to missed serves after the timeout. Because this is a question I get a lot. Like, it feels to me like every time they call a timeout, your team comes out and blows it, coach. What can you do to help your team deal with that? Right. So we looked at the number of missed serves after the timeout compared to prior to the timeout and to the typical rate of missed serves in general. So here's what we found in terms of serving behaviors. About two-thirds of the time, the server is going to go back and deliver the same ball. About a quarter of the time, you're going to get an easier serve. And so this is actually supported, if you guys remember from the Polish league, this is supported from the idea that there are less aces and serving reception improves after a timeout. So what you see is, one, the opponent, it appears your opponent kind of takes their foot off the pedal when you call a timeout. So we also looked at the rate of missed serves. Okay, so there were 300 timeouts, 18 missed serves. Okay, so that's at a rate of 6%. Tennessee Tech played about 5,500 points in their season. They missed about 426 serves, and that's at a rate of about 7%. That's not statistically different. Okay. So it doesn't seem like they miss their serve more frequently. If anything, they miss their serves less frequently because they're serving easier. Interesting thing to note, and I think this is why we hold the belief that people tend to miss serves after timeouts, because if we compare the number of missed serves after a timeout to prior to a timeout, is that about a 1%? Okay? So if you think about the number of times that a coach would take a timeout after a missed serve occurs, that's not very frequent, right? That tends to not happen. So if we have this false comparison of, you know, missing your serve after a timeout, prior to a timeout, yeah, it seems like people are missing their serves a lot, right? But that's not different than the typical rate of play. So that's serving behavior. And next, what we looked at was passing behavior. Passing behavior is important because it seems like timeouts are it's probably the number one reason why coaches take timeouts. Right? About two-thirds of the time, coaches take a timeout after an ace, overpass, or a one pass. So we rated passes on a traditional 0 to 3 scale, 0 being an ace, 1 being a 1 pass, and 3 being a perfect pass. Same thing with serves. 3 things could be true. You could pass better, you could pass worse, or you can pass about the same. So what we see here is that essentially there's a drastic change in negative passing behavior and also positive passing behavior. Right? After a timeout, okay, you get ace less, you overpass less, you pass less one balls, you pass more two balls, and you pass more three balls. So if we split it, it seems like it's affecting the server in terms of their aggressiveness. It seems like they're serving easier, and it seems like your team is passing better. Okay? And obviously those two things are connected. So what we see here is that if we just look at passing behavior alone, it improved 43% of the time. Right? And that's higher than it's not due to just serving, right? Because serving easier only occurs 24% of the time. So your team here is actually passing better. Right? Your team here is passing better, right? About a third of the time they're going to be the same, and about 22% they're actually going to get worse. But you do see a little bit of a return here, right, in terms of your team's passing. So, what did we find? Okay, timeouts can alter behaviors in favor of the team taking the timeout. Okay, it seems to reduce the opponent's psychological momentum in terms of forcing them to serve easier. It also improves your own team's performance in terms of its passing behavior. From a psychological perspective, we think timeouts may be a good kind of reset point for reinforcement. Right. If your team is giving up a bunch of points, it's getting a bunch of negative reinforcement, right? Or it's getting a lot of messages that reinforce the idea that they're not performing well. Maybe timeouts can serve as this nice reset point to help increase their self-efficacy. Some limitations to this study. For one, we only had a single rater. Okay, I love Danielle, but who knows? Maybe Danielle had some rough mornings where maybe she didn't rate the serves well, or maybe she had her own beliefs about what timeout should do, and so that might affect how she sees the serves. Right? And this may be kind of idiosyncratic to Tennessee Tech. and their level of play. Maybe this doesn't translate to other levels of play. So right now, what I'm doing is I'm looking at other conferences. I'm looking at Conference USA. So they're sort of the middle of the pack if you look at their median RPI. Right? And I'm also looking at the SWAC. Traditionally, their RPI is at the bottom. So I just want to see how it translates to other levels of play. Just briefly, I want to show you kind of differences in coaches' behaviors in taking timeouts. So this is Conference USA. This is in terms of point differential. This is pretty identical to the Big Ten. So coaches are taking timeouts, usually, you know, around half of them take timeouts when it's within 3 points, and most of them take timeouts when it's within 5 points. If you see the SWAC, it's more kind of evenly distributed. Right? There's really kind of no clear pattern here of when these coaches are choosing to take timeouts. Also, if you look at timeout behaviors during runs, okay, Conference USA, again, I'm not taking the Big 10 graph and just putting a different label on it. It seems like it's pretty similar behaviors. You look at the SWAC, again, the behaviors tend to be different in terms of how coaches use timeouts. I think the easy thing to say here is that maybe somehow SWAC coaches are different. I would kind of caution you against that kind of interpretation. It could be that that level of play forces you to strategize your game differently. Maybe the game is more volatile and that runs occur differently. Like, I know some of you guys coach 12s, and like that level is probably, you know, it's like 12 points, and then their best server gets back and they win the game. And you're like, what? I was just up 12 points, right? So, That's not to say that the SWAC, that might have been a bad example, because I may have just made it worse. That's to say that as the level of play decreases, I think there's just more volatility. And I think these coaches may be adapting to that level of volatility and not so much that their coaching potential or ability is different or anything like that. All right, so more to come. I'm still analyzing that data. Okay. So takeaway message for today, I think there's two. Okay, pick one. The simple one is timeouts don't work. Okay, use them however you want them. Timeouts don't work because the average side-out rate after a timeout is exactly the same as the average side-out rate of typical play. Okay, so you can take that. I think that's the simple explanation. Okay. But I think there's more nuance to that. I think the more nuanced explanation, okay, is that timeouts are situationally dependent. You have to take it when the match is within reach. I think you have to take it before momentum swings. Okay, and there seems to be a cliff at 3 points. I think the level of ability matters here. Okay, even though your timeout enables you to get an easier serve, even though your timeout enables you to pass the ball better, maybe, you know, if your team is playing Penn State, it doesn't matter if they freeball you the ball, you're not going to side out anyways, right? So it may affect the initial behavior, but it may not affect the overall outcome. And you can actually argue that getting back to baseline may actually be success, right? If your team is down by 3 or by 4, or the other team is getting on a 3-4 point run, and you can get them to side out at the same rate as they normally do, some people might consider that a success. Right. So those are the two storylines. I think, again, the simple way is just, hey, use them however you want them. But I think there's more nuance to that. And obviously, here we're just talking about timeouts in terms of, hey, can it help you side out? But timeouts are so much more. Right. Typically, timeouts are when your players actually pay attention to you. Use it as a teaching moment. So I just want to acknowledge a few people who are instrumental for making this research happen. These are my research assistants. They hope to collect a lot of the data. Danielle, the club I work for, Armstrong, Will Condon, who's the head coach at Armstrong. We're big volleyball nerds, so we've been able to bounce back a few of these ideas. Okay, I'd love to take some questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. team success rate afterward. The team went on a 3-point run. This team took a timeout. What's their success rate versus the team that didn't take a timeout? And what's their success rate on the fourth point?
Uh-huh. So we did that a little bit for the Big Ten, and I think I may have mentioned it, although.
Can you repeat the question?
Oh, yes, sorry. So the question was, did I look at the side-out rate after a team goes on a three-point run compared to when a team goes on a run of more than 3 points? Is that right?
Well, the team that took the timeout
Right. I thought I did that. Maybe it's unclear here. So if you look at this one, so this is what happens when a team takes a timeout between 1 and 3 points, and this is what happens when you wait. So there seems to be about a 5% difference in a team that waits versus a team that takes it early. I'm not sure if that helps to address your question. Maybe we can talk afterwards. Maybe we can do that. Other questions? Yes, sir. All the way in the back.
I was curious if you know if there's data on taking timeouts for the opposite reason, so to get a stop on defense.
Yes, yes.
Especially late in sets, when you have more data on the opposing hitters, like your teams improve their chance to take stops at like 24, 22.
I think that's a really good question. The question was, what happens if you're the serving team and you take a timeout for a defensive strategic session, right? To maybe make sure that you key up on their best hitter. Maybe they run a unique pattern here and you want to alert your players to that, right? I specifically didn't look at that. I didn't look at timeouts by the serving team, mostly because they're so rare. In the Tennessee season, that happened 3 times. And so, and I think the next question is probably, would I recommend that you take a timeout when your team is serving? I think it depends on which takeaway message you go with, right? If timeouts don't matter, sure, take them whenever you want. And especially if you're used to having your players deal with timeouts when you're serving. But I think generally I would not do it because statistically I'm going to lose that point and I'm going to look bad. Okay? If my team's going to lose that point at about 58% of the time, I don't need parents breathing down my neck saying, why'd you take a timeout when your team was serving? That seems like a silly thing to do. Right? Now, if you're well-known, if you're, you know, Russ Rose, if you do that, you may change how timeouts are used, right? If I do that, I might get fired, right? Or parents are going to at least be down my throat. Do you have a question? Okay.
When you talk about grading of the serving, is that mm-hmm. independent of the pass? Like when you rate the serve, whether it was a good serve or a weaker serve, is that independent of the result?
Yes. Yeah. So we rated the serve and then we rated the pass independently. I guess we can go back and we can see the correlation between the serve and the pass. I think that's a really good point. Yeah. Very good. Yes, sir.
So do you have data on how frequently runs tend to self-extinguish after 3 points as opposed to sort of the frequency distribution of the lengths of the run? Because it seems like a lot of times they go three and then...
Fascinating. Yeah, so it's this idea that it's probably hard for teams to score 4 points in a row. You can just kind of wait it out. From what I saw, and I'm still working on that, it sides out at your typical rate, which is around 59-60%. But I'm still working on that. Yeah. Other questions? Yes?
Any data on the importance of the game and how that influenced whether it was a do or die game or just regular season or non-conference versus conference?
Yeah.
Do you have any of that?
I don't have that, but I think that's a great future direction. I think there's a lot more to kind of discover here, and I think that would be a great direction. Thank you. Yes, sir?
Do you have any data or anything on what the spread of the score was before the run started? Like if you're up 10-0 and then get a 3-0 run?
Interesting. So not just looking at runs and point differential, but combining those together. I haven't looked at that, but I have that data. I can probably go back and crunch the numbers pretty easily. my intuition is that if those two things are multiplied, it gets way worse. If there's a big point differential and there's a longer run, it probably doesn't bode well for the side out team. That's a good question. Yes, ma'am. Man, I think that's a really good question. I think Mark, the guy who published the other research, he is on the take timeouts whenever timeouts don't work. And I feel slightly biased the other way. I feel like timeouts are an important tool. And maybe some of that, some of what I presented kind of confirmed what I believe. But I typically don't wait for long runs, when I'm coaching. In terms of talking to my players, I think every coach has a different strategy. But I think timeouts, as I mentioned, are a good opportunity to kind of reset your expectations. Typically, and this is one thing we don't think about timeouts, is that timeouts reinforce the idea that you're sucking, right? Like, so maybe that's why timeouts don't work, because you only take them when you're sucking, right? That when you're failing. So I think you can have a productive conversation with your players about, you know, this is when I take timeouts. I'm not taking a timeout because you're performing poorly. This is my point to reinforce some things that you want to get across. Although that is not something I've started doing. I am more aware of runs. I tend to not let runs get out of hand. And I'm more aware of point differential, where I tend to not let those things get out of hand. Yes, sir.
So kind of piggybacking off the same thing. So you're talking about athletes believing in the hot hand effect.
Mm-hmm.
What about using that if your opponent's calling the timeouts? I mean, have you fed into that psychology, their already preconceived notions that we're doing well, continuing to feed that psychology?
That's interesting. So how would you do it?
I mean, first, I think making it, like you said, they're kind of already aware.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of continue, hey, we're doing really well, instead of maybe getting too analytical with the game, just kind of getting them to fuel that,
yeah,
that belief, hey, we're,
yeah,
doing well.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if we allow them to brush aside some mistakes maybe that we've made and continue to fuel that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think usually when the other team takes a timeout, maybe the coach thinks about, like, oh, can you not miss this next serve, right? Maybe instead of telling them to kind of take their foot off the pedal, that you just kind of allow them to do what they normally would do. And obviously, I think you would have to train for that, because there are a lot of factors that say, like, hey, a timeout has been taken, I have to do something differently. And if you can train your players to ignore that and just focus on just executing the skill the same way they would at any situation, I think that would be great. But also, if you can get your players to do that, you'd make a lot of money. Right. If you found the secret to just letting your players play the same way at any situation, I think you'd probably make a lot of money under that. Other questions? Yes, sir.
I think to piggyback off what he said, I think it would be interesting, or I don't know if it's even possible, but to look at what content is given to the players during their timeout.
Yes.
Whether, to his point, it is feed the emotional beast, right? Every time I see a timeout taken in the club, right, the club team that is on the run cheers.
Yeah.
Very different psychological state for the other team. So then what is said in the timeout to either feed that beast or change direction and refocus tactically on the non-winning side of,
yeah,
the run being scored on? It'd be interesting to see some kind of correlation between what content is given in different situations and how that might impact the outcome.
Yeah, so shoot, I was supposed to be repeating questions. I've been blowing it this whole time. So the question was that it would be interesting to see what the content of the coach's sort of speech during the timeout is. And I think you're totally right. I think whether we look at motivational strategies or if we look at tactical strategies, if you think about it, typically when teams give up a run, and maybe this is in my own personal limited experience, but when the coach calls a timeout, it's much more motivational than it is strategy. Maybe coaches should consider a change, although I don't have any evidence to support that. So, other questions? Well, I'm available. You guys can always email me. I'm around for the weekend. I really appreciate your time. Thanks, guys.